great man, Chirag.
Yes, sir.
Giving you time to switch off your phone.
How did you know?
I've switched off the cheapest cell phone in the room, and the cheapest watch in the room says it's 8 minutes past whatever. Welcome to the Deputy Minister, and also to Mr. Sanjay Karim, and everyone else who join us from the department. And members, you are also welcome, and interested parties. We'll commence with a briefing by Dr. Rob Davis. When you are ready, we are in your able hands.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. The purpose of our presentation today is to update the committee on some of the issues and challenges in the trade negotiations. I'm going to focus on the WTO Doha round, on the SADC regional integration, and particularly the free trade area and the customs union program, and then the SADC EU economic partnership agreement negotiation. Xavier Karim, the DDG of ICED, I don't know if he's been DDG. Since he's been DDG, if he's been to the committee before, but he's been DDG for a few months now. Xavier will add to some of the remarks I make about these three, and we'll also say a few words about IPSA and NEPAD, which was the request of the committee. So let me start with the WTO. What happened was that you will all recall, I think probably the last time we came here at the time that the formal negotiating process was suspended in July last year, suspended because the differences were between the members were so large that the process wasn't making any advance, and a formal decision was taken at the trade negotiating committee to suspend the negotiations. At the beginning of this year, I think starting with Davos and meetings of that sort, some momentum was developed to resume the process, and the formal process resumed in the course of this year. And it resumed in a twin-track process. The first was a series of meetings between the G4. The G4 group of four, this is the EU, the US, Brazil, and India. And this group of countries are considered to be representative of some of the major trends. And the idea was that small group meetings between the G4 would create a dynamic which would then infuse into the multilateral process. But at the same time and simultaneously, the formal multilateral process also continued. And in particular, there were working groups on different subjects, the most important ones being agriculture and non-agricultural market access, of course, being industrial tariffs, also working groups on services and on some of the other subjects. And these working groups were started off with informal consultations called fireside chats or enchiladas with the Mexican ambassador's one, and confessionals was the one on NAMA, and then it moved from that into drafting of text later on, as you will see. Now, the thing is that the G4 process actually broke down. There were a number of meetings of the G4. They actually started off not meeting together as the G4. They were in the same hotel or something like that, but they met bilaterally, not as all four of them together. But then eventually they did start meeting all four together. But this process broke down in Potsdam in June of this year. And it really broke down on a fundamental issue which continues to bedevil these negotiations. The US and the EU had more or less, like they did it at Cancun, they had kind of come together and agreed to more or less moderate their demands against each other in the areas of agriculture. But they had united on very ambitious demands against so-called advanced developing countries in the area of non-agricultural market access or industrial tariffs. So in Potsdam, the U.S. offered to cut its overall trade distorting support. This is the domestic production subsidies on agriculture. It offered to cut these to a level of $17 billion. It would be entitled each year to dispense $17 billion of trade distorting, what's recognized as trade distorting domestic support. This compares to its current allowed dispersal of $22 billion. That would be a cut compared to what it's allowed to dispense, but it would actually allow an increase over what it actually dispenses this year, which is $11 billion of applied aid. So it is proposing a fairly modest cut in overall trade distorting support. The European Union at the same time was offering overall cuts on agricultural tariffs, which were in aggregate terms don't seem to be too far off what the G20 was demanding, but they were looking for lots of wiggle room in terms of their ability to declare sensitive products and to leave out sensitive agricultural products from those cuts. So while they were, each of them moderated their positions towards each other, they insisted on advanced developing countries making sharp applied cuts in industrial tariffs, demanding a Swiss formula with a coefficient of 18. Now I'm going to come back a little bit later and say what do these coefficients mean in terms of tariff cuts. There'll be a table of that. But they demanded 18 of the coefficients. Now that process then broke down, and then the Director General, through the Trade Negotiation Committee, mandated the multilateral process to move from the chairs drafting what are called challenge papers to actually drafting text. And negotiating text on agriculture and on NAMA were circulated in July this year. The European institutions are quite funny really, because whatever the time demands and however urgent all these matters are, they all have to go off on holiday in the month of August. So there was some work that happened during July, they've gone off in August, and then they'll resume again in September, and we'll see what happens in September. But the agricultural text, when it came out, it broadly accommodated most positions. It actually, I think, was fairly broadly accepted as a basis for negotiation, because, for example, on the overall trade distorting support, it said that the U.S. cut should be in the teens. And that could be anything from $13 billion to $19 billion. So it accommodates the demands of the G20 on agriculture. It also accommodates the demands of the United States on that. And on all the other subjects, it broadly speaking accommodates most positions, so that this is the range of possible settlements. But of course, because it does that, it leaves the outcome uncertain. The final landing ground remains uncertain. The U.S. continues to insist on headroom, as it's called, above its current applied overall trade distorting support. So it insists that it's not going to cut into its current applied level. It's not going to go below 12. And the EU position on agricultural market access still envisages fairly modest average cuts and then wiggle room around sensitive products. The text on NAMA, though, The text on NAMA was much more prescriptive. It recommended a Swiss formula with coefficients of 8 to 9 for developed countries and 19 to 23 for developing countries. On the question of sensitivities, which South Africa has been among groups of countries calling for some enlargement of the flexibilities, it's proposed simply removing the square brackets around the 2005 July framework paper, which says that there should be a 5% flexibility for developing countries. You can leave 5% of your tariff lines outside of the formula cuts, or, not and, or, you can have 10% of your tariff lines going to 50%, not more than 50% of the formula cut. The paper which came out from the chair of NAMA says that it was aware of a request from by South Africa, particularly mentioned for additional flexibilities, but was unable to offer any recommendation without additional mandate. And the case for the additional flexibilities was that South Africa took cuts of developed countries in the Uruguay round, and also that we're in a customs union with more vulnerable economies and one least developed country. But the chair says is aware of the request but wasn't able to make a recommendation. What does this mean? This is a table which shows if you have a this is the tariff that you start with, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. This is broadly the range of tariffs that we have in South Africa. If you apply a Swiss formula and a coefficient of 19, what does that take that tariff down to? The next column is if you apply a Swiss formula with a coefficient of 23, what does it take that tariff down to? And then the other two columns are if you took the 10% flexibility, if you took the cut down to not more than 50% more than the formula cut, what would that take it down to? And you can see what happens if this formula takes the highest tariffs down the most. 45% is a number of lines in clothing and textiles are 45% in South Africa at the moment. The bound rate is 45, the applied rate is 40. You start from the bound rate. If a Swiss formula with a coefficient of 19 were applied and we didn't use the flexibility on those lines, it would take the tariff down from 45% to 13%. If it were 23, it takes the tariff down from 45 to 15%. If we apply the flexibility according to the 10% of the lines, it would take the tariff down to 29 or 30. If it was 40, 13, 14, 26, 27, 30 would go 12, 13, 24, 24, 20 would go 9, 10, 14, 15, and 10 would go down to 6%, 7%, or 8% if we use the flexibility. So that's the sort of extent of the cuts that would be applied they're quite steep cuts, and particularly in the more sensitive sectors, they're quite steep. Just before the European recess, there was discussion on these papers. As I said already, the agriculture one was more or less envisaged as accepted as a basis for negotiation. But the NAMA one was highly criticized by developing countries, five developing countries, groups representing in total 101 countries. It was actually the NAMA 11 plus the G90, which gives you 101. They were highly critical of the NAMA text. Substantial imbalances were seen in the whole process. And the whole thing was criticized as an attempt to reinterpret the mandate of the Doha round. I actually quite like the phrase that the Brazilian ambassador used. He said that there was an attempt to reinterpret the Doha round from a development round to a market access in developing countries round. So in other words, the developing countries, us among them, would take real applied cuts in industrial tariffs, but developed countries on these proposals would not be taking real applied cuts in trade-distorting subsidies on agriculture. That's the way the proposals look at the moment, and the developing countries have said that this is fundamentally imbalanced. Now, where does this leave us? They've all gone off for their holidays. The next steps, as envisaged, are possible revised texts. the chairs after the debate may come back with revised texts, and we'll have to see what those revised texts look like. There will be some engagement with those revised texts in Geneva. There's a possibility that the Director General may decide to call a ministerial meeting, but probably if there's a degree of convergence. But the point that we're making at the conclusion here is time is actually running out. We're probably talking about the month of September, early October. There will either be some sort of resolution of this process, or it will become overtaken by the U.S. Presidential election dynamic. The U.S. won't be able to make any movement on this, and this particular window of opportunity, as it's called in the WTO speak, may well close. So that's the update, and we can come back and discuss that. That's where we stand on the
Chair, I wonder whether it wouldn't be a good idea to pause and discuss this, because it's really quite different to the static issues.
In your hands.
Okay. Before we perhaps go on to SADC, although there's a relationship between WTO and SADC, but let's perhaps take a comment. Questions for clarification on this first question. Comrade Ben?
Yeah, no surprise. I'm one of the people who wants to say something, Chair. I've been reading some material on this whole negotiation, and I must say I find it very depressing, as I'm sure the Deputy Minister does too. But I asked myself some rather fundamental questions, and I think that, fortunately, not being close to negotiations, I try to stand back from all the detail, because one can get caught up in all this business about bound rates and applied rates and so on, and say, well, a small fraction here or a small fraction there makes a difference. But it seems to me this committee ought to deal in fundamentals rather than the fractions. And it seems to me, I asked myself a number of questions, and I'd ask the Deputy Minister to perhaps respond. My first question is, why is it that we were ever persuaded that it's possible to have a fair, rule-based international arrangement? Because clearly, after so many years of discussion, it's clear that the US and EU will not go towards a fair, international, rule-based system. They don't want that. So the question I ask is, why were we ever persuaded that this would be possible? The second question is this: even if an agreement is reached, are we sure that there will be compliance in the EU in particular, but also the US? Because all the evidence on agricultural subsidy support, farmer support, and so on, shows that even as they appear to comply with some mandate, they undermine it by other means. I was in Europe a little while ago, and I was told how the system works with farmer support and so on. I mean, all sorts of excuses are given. We're protecting nature. We're protecting our forests and so on, our natural environment. All sorts of excuses are made for subsidizing people who don't work necessarily, but we live in the rural areas in France, in all those countries. So, compliance. Thirdly, the emphasis, it seems to me, in any discussion on this, is that it is supposed to be a development round. Now, I suppose we could say that at Doha, the word development was inserted as a kind of smokescreen, because the developed countries thought that by putting that in, the developing countries would be more compliant. But clearly, it's not a development round, as I shall indicate in a moment. Some economists, development economists, are saying very clearly, Ajun Chang in particular, but others, Vilma Zakuz and others, are saying that a developing country which wants to industrialize has to exercise a degree of protection. Now, this is not on the table in this discussion. It is absolutely required that a country which wants to industrialize must protect. The US did it, the EU did it, they all did it. now that we're wanting to do a bit of it, it comes into some sort of negotiated agreement, which is around fractions of this or that. It seems to me that we ought to stand firm and say, we as a developing country insist on our right to exercise protection of infant industries and of industries which we think are essential for the future development of our infrastructure and of our country. I think we should stand firm on that. Finally, this business of time running out. Why should we be so sensitive about the U.S.'s mandate? If the U.S. wants to do a deal, they will do a deal. The question of time running out is merely a kind of hanging a noose over your head. And I don't think we should really refer to it or take cognizance of it. If it runs out, it runs out. The chances are it's going to run out anyway. And I don't like this business of the U.S. exercising a kind of almost a pressure on us by this so-called time running out. I don't think we should succumb to it. And I personally think we shouldn't even refer to it or take account of it. The negotiation will proceed. If it proceeds and goes well, it goes well. Not on a basis of a U.S., I'm trying to think of the right word, sort of guillotine. We should not be interested in that. Thank you.
Professor Chiro, thank you. Before I give you the chance, Comrade Hartman, Shalim, could you kindly go next door? I'm not sure who's carrying the Shabim next door. But if they can consume the liquor at the mall.
Okay, I'll see.
There's a gap in the door.
Quietly. Right, yeah. Comrade Hartman.
Chair, my question is around the window of opportunity. Window of opportunity, what does that entail? What does it mean in actual terms? And who is giving this message to others? It seems that this person that give us this opportunity, this message, and if you don't do this, then things are not going to happen. And also related to some questions asked by Professor Durok, why would the U.S. always have laws, legislation that would prevent negotiations, trade laws in particular? And what is the thinking of other groups, G20s, and the rest, G90, about this? And is there any thinking that we could also think about having such laws in order to protect our economy, not only one industry, our economy? Yeah, those are the two questions.
Thank you. Mr. Labashakni, sir.
Thanks, Jay. I'm just very curious, you know, as to where do we go from here? And what do? We don't reach agreement. What's the consequences? What happens then? Where do we stand? I'm interested in China's position. You know, we have Brazil and India. You know, China is most probably the biggest, strongest member of the developing world. Where do they stand in this? And, you know, as you say in your, yeah, the flaws in the draft set must be corrected, which I certainly go along with, but what happens if they can't be? Where do we stand? Thank you.
What meeting is this? What meeting is this? Please just speak to Twitter, wherever is the chairperson. Tell them they are disturbing this meeting.
I will.
Thanks.
Drink tea, not talk tea.
Peter.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. My third question is the link, of course, to the compliance and the guarantee. In particular, I want to address that the cattle sector. I just want to know, in terms of that compliance, in the sense that now there is this development of the biofuel issue. And I'm told as early or as late as last week that the U.S. is intending to give more subsidy to the farmers, and in particular because they want them to produce more maize and other products for the biofuel. And I'm looking in terms of the compliance, what guarantee do we have that that particular compliance is going to be complied accordingly? And also the fact that the farmers in South Africa are not subsidized at all. And because of this biofuel that is coming up now, there will be a more demand for the production of these biofuel products as soon as possible. That's what I have to address in terms of that particular one. But I also advise that the EU also wants to follow the same route, because the United States is running out of maize and soybeans for these biofuels in particular. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Deputy Minister, that's a chance for you to rejoin us.
Yeah, okay, thanks. And I'll also let Xavier add on some point. I'll just take the questions as they came. I don't know if we were ever persuaded that a fair rules-based system in terms of some kind of ideal type was ever on the cards. I mean, I don't think I was ever persuaded of that anyway. But could we have achieved a fairer, and were there some advantages for a multilateral rules-based system? I think we basically would have argued that that both those are in the realm of possibility, and that we should have taken the opportunities that were there. And I think the old argument is that through a multilateral and a rules-based system, in which developing countries hypothetically at least have an equal say in the formulation of the rules, there is a better opportunity to secure some changes to the benefits of developing countries than there is in just straight bilateral negotiations. I mean, we confront the European Union bilaterally. There is no way that on the table in those negotiations is even one piece of agricultural subsidies or issues of that sort. So the only way you can address those matters as a developing country is by gathering forces through the multilateral system. But I don't think that there was ever any sense among more sober analysts that we were suddenly going to achieve an ideal type. But what was available through the collapse in Seattle and the momentum that arose from that, because the collapse in Seattle, I think it was fundamentally the collapse inside the negotiation, not the what happened outside, but what happened inside. The collapse was because developing countries felt that they were being left out of the decisions and they were not prepared to be part of the deal, that they didn't have any part in shaping. And that led to a dynamic which emerged in Doha. And the Doha Declaration actually says that the needs and interests of developing countries are supposed to be placed at the heart of the work program. Now, I think everything that's happened since then, we can question the extent to which that has been achieved, but that was the mandate from Doha. And when we criticize, for example, the NAMA test, we use the point of reference of the Doha mandate, and we say that it's out of sync with that. So I think that we would continue to say that there are some gains that we can make in the direction of addressing some of the issues for developing countries through the multilateral process. But of course, that this is going to be a tough and hard bargaining. The fact that you win a battle over a declaratory text like the Doha mandate does not mean that that's followed through in every single issue. Now, I think in terms of if there's an agreement, will there be compliance? I think that we need to recognize that particularly, I think, on agricultural trade, that there is a sort of a progression of issues, and even on other industrial tariffs. And that what we're addressing in this negotiation in agriculture, let's say, are matters of tariffs, high tariffs, against competitive products of developing countries, and subsidies on exports in particular, which should be eliminated, and then reductions of production-based subsidies, and particularly those that distort. Now, that doesn't mean that all subsidies are going to be eliminated. I mean, I've given you all the figures. Even if the G20 gets its way, the United States and the European Union will still be able to deploy sizable subsidies on agricultural products legally through the WTO. Perfectly legally, they'll still be able to do it. What's on the table is not an elimination of those. But we still think it's important to get the reduction. The reduction is better than nothing, but there won't be that elimination. But even if we were to eliminate subsidies, that doesn't mean that we suddenly reach an ideal type of fair trade system. Because the next issue that comes up, which is not being addressed fully in front of me in this negotiation, but is the issue of the future, are technical barriers to trade and standards. And the use of standards as technical barriers to trade in agriculture is the issue of the future. And similarly in industrial goods, standards again, as well as other kinds of regulations, can be deployed to replace reduced tariffs as protective measures. So I think we need to be aware that we are in a game which is in which the rules in the past were fundamentally set by developed countries in the interest of developed countries, and in which all that's on the table is for us to make a bit of headway, not to fundamentally put in place an ideal type fair trade system that we would like to see in place. But I think that what is achievable is worth having. Now, the other question that was posed was developing countries, industrialization, we need some policy space to deploy tariffs. I mean, we would agree with that. And one of the reasons that we have called for an expansion of the flexibilities in the NAFTA negotiations is precisely that. We don't necessarily need to have high tariffs across the board, but we do need to have policy space to be able to deploy tariffs in defense of industrialization processes informed by industrial policy. The industrial policy framework actually calls for industrial policy to shape our tariff policy rather than the other way around. So we would agree that we need that space, and that's one of the factors which is behind the position that we push for in the NAFTA negotiations is precisely informed by that. And the Swiss formula is a very blunt instrument, as you see. It takes particularly the higher tariffs down much more quickly. And for us, very important is the question of enlarging those flexibilities. The window of opportunity, that was a phrase, I mean, I tested this, it's a great idea to use a phrase from WTOC, but that's the phrase that's used in this context. And I think what the idea is that there's a sense that there's a number of time frames where this thing might be settled, and this is the one that we're in at the moment. The one after the U.S. congressional elections and before the overwhelming of the U.S. domestic process by presidential elections. Now, whether that window of opportunity results in an agreement that is developmental in content, because our position is that the content of the agreement is as important as the fact of an agreement, that's really an open question. I didn't express any view on it. I mean, you know, there's going to have to be some very, very sharp differences between the a revised paper on Gamma and the current paper on Gamma, if that window is going to close in any way successfully from our point of view. But if this one closes, then the next one would probably be after the next administration in the United States. Now, are we bound by the U.S. and so on and so forth, and should we be? Well, one of the things that is important is, first of all, the U.S. is an important player. We have to acknowledge that. If they're not part of an agreement, there's no agreement. So we have to acknowledge that. What they do have is they have something called Trade Promotion Authority, which would now need to be renewed. And if the U.S. doesn't have Trade Promotion Authority, what happens is that if there is an agreement, their Congress can sit line by line, product by product, and amend it. They wouldn't be presented with like we are usually when we have to ratify something, a take it or leave it decision. They would be if the Trade Promotion Authority is in place, they would be presented with a take it or leave it decision. If there's no Trade Promotion Authority in place, then Congress can sit down and amend line by line, item by item, the agreement, and you would be negotiating with the U.S. Congress. Now, if they don't have any Trade Promotion Authority, the negotiators are not going to be able to go to the negotiation with any definite position. And at the moment, one of the issues that's there is they can't make any offers that are going to appeal to anybody. That's one of the real reasons why this window is quite problematic. But I do think there's a bit of a lesson for us here, because the U.S. uses their legislature and the positions that their legislature would take very prominently in the negotiations. So we all know what Congress, broadly speaking, is thinking and feeling. Everybody is trying to understand this to some degree. But our legislatures are not as active and prominent in these debates as they should be. That's a message I've been saying for ages, is that our legislatures need to become much more prominent in these debates, and we need to have some points of reference. I mean, we have to be able to sit in the negotiations and say, well, actually, you can sit here and persuade us and tire us all out after meeting and with no sleep, but I'm not going to be able to take this back and sell this in my legislature, because that's never a reality that features in the negotiations. And the more it could, the better I think it would be for people involved in the negotiations. Mr. Lovescotti's question: if we don't succeed now, where to? I never felt the world will come tumbling down. I mean, some people do think it is. We will lose some opportunities to put some disciplines on some subsidies. And that will mean some lost opportunity for us. But it's not the end of the world. There will be bilateralism rather than multilateralism in trade negotiations. We will have to define our bilateral agendas much more carefully. We will face all the demands that the and you'll see when we come to the discussion on FIFA, you'll see how they're there. The bilateral demands, the things that were kicked off the WTO agenda, are now back on the bilateral agenda. We will face those. We will have to take our positions in bilateral processes. But I do think that the world is changing in ways that we need to take account of, and maybe Xavier wants to say a few things about this, but China, IPSA, those processes, I think are things where we need to place some very serious emphasis. And our alternatives are not simply that we have to just sign on to any demand which the United States or the European Union wants to put on us. We do have alternatives in the South, resulting from real changes in the global economy. On the question of biofuel and subsidies that David Lally raised, what is happening is that while the U.S. is engaging in the WTO process, they're also simultaneously developing a new farm bill. And the new farm bill will be shaped by their perceptions of the process. And if they don't think they're going to get anything out of the WTO process, they will put stuff in the farm bill which will, send the subsidies in a different direction. I think that the biofuel issue is a critical issue. I mean, the countries that are competitive in biofuels at the moment, countries like Brazil and so on, are competitors. They will want to take steps to support some of their own farmers and things like that. I mean, there is a bit of an issue on that, which I'm slightly aware of, but not an expert on by any means, but the new generation of biofuels is not actually using food crops. It's not maize and soybeans, it's non-food crops. And I don't know how that would affect the whole thing, but I mean, look, if the multinational process doesn't advance, then the U.S. will put in place a farm bill, which will be shaped by different considerations and the pressure of lobbyists and so on and so forth, and well, the subsidies may well be more formidable. I don't know if David wants to add a few points.
Thank you very much, Dr. Davis. Mr. Karim, is there anything that you'd like to add?
Thanks very much, Chair. Maybe just to underline a couple of key points that the Deputy Minister has already outlined. The South African government's position on this has on the WTO has always been that the global rules are important. And to the extent that we can strengthen them in a manner that promotes development is an important objective in itself. But I think as we've said that, we've also repeated that the current rules that we've inherited from the Uruguay round and from previous rounds have been shaped by developed countries, industrial countries, and that these rules are imbalanced and inequitous in a number of respects. And that was the fundamental motivation for supporting the launch of this round of negotiations. The view was that it's through this negotiating process that we would be able to address these imbalances in the existing rules. And that, I think that was the main motivation for South Africa in supporting the launch of the round in Doha. I think it's also important to recognize that the Doha mandate was an important advance for developing countries. It has a developmental content to it. It sets a trajectory in a particular way that highlights issues of critical importance for developing countries that would need to be achieved. But again, it's a mandate. It simply sets a trajectory. The details of it are what we have to negotiate, and that's the difficulty in it. But that's also been a form of protection for us in these negotiations, including in the area of NAMA, of industrial tariff negotiations, where the U.S. and the EU have tried to shift the negotiations of pressure on developing countries. We've been able to use the mandate as a defense against that type of aggressive market opening objectives of the U.S. by referring to the Doha mandate, the developmental content in the mandate. So the mandate is quite important. I think the third critical point to recognize in this is that the negotiating dynamic in the trading system has changed. We're no longer talking of agreements whereby the U.S. and the EU and a few industrial countries can get together, cobble together something that's dangerous and force it down the throat of developing countries, which was in large measure the case during the Uruguay round. The emergence of the G20 in this round, group of developing countries, the emergence of the NAMA 11 have successfully changed the negotiating dynamic. As we're able to now articulate well-defined positions, technically sound positions with some economic trade weight in the system that are able to resist it. And that's also an important development. And then I think finally, taking all of that into account, one would have to say that it's important to try to meet, to conclude the negotiations as soon as possible, because the system is prejudiced against developing countries. The longer it remains intact, the more our interests are prejudiced. So it's important to conclude the negotiations as soon as possible, but more important than the timing is the content. And the content is the developmental mandate. So long as the negotiations are ongoing, as long as the mandate is set out in front of us, we should be trying to make the advances. And again, it's not going to make the system fair, but it will make it fair. And it's important, I think, as part of a longer-term historical process, to see that as moving towards a fair system. I think those are maybe some points to underline from the Deputy Minister. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we should move on. Some of the other aspects will be interrelated to the next issue of SEDEC and NEPAD.
Let me go through this, because the next one actually is something which we need as a country to pay very serious attention to in the next few months. And this is the SEDEC integration process. And just a little bit of background, the SADC has adopted some years ago a regional indicative strategic development plan, which included a number of milestones for promoting regional integration. It envisaged that there would be established in SADC, through the processes of the 1996 Maseru Trade Protocol, a free trade area in 2008. A free trade area, I think we should just qualify this by saying, because there are two ways in which free trade areas are understood. The literal textbook free trade area is that you have duty-free trade among the members of the free trade area for all products. But the WTO recognizes that you can have a free trade area if you remove duties on quote-unquote substantially all trade, which is less than all trade. And the Maseru Protocol, in fact, envisaged a process of removing duties on substantially all trade, not literally all trade. The next part in the Regional Indicative Strategic Development Plan is that it envisages that there will be a customs union in SADC by 2010. Now, a customs union is you have duty-free trade among yourselves, and then you have a common external tariff. You have the same tariff towards the outside world. That's what we have in SACU at the moment. The tariff that's enforced in South Africa is also enforced in Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland. And what SADC envisages is that we should make a shift up to a customs union by 2010, so it's just around the corner. Then we should have a common market, and that common market is basically you would have free movement of all the factors of production, which would include labor, capital, things of that sort, by 2015. And we should have monetary union in 2016, and we should be having a single currency by 2018. I think that's the process. Now, this has been on the agenda for a long time, but last year at the summit, 2006 summit, heads of state said, well, what are we doing about this, and particularly about the customs union? And then there was a decision that there would be a special summit, which was held in October last year. The special summit decided to commission some research, and it's debates around that countries, member states are supposed to be engaging in the next few months. Now, the next bullet just simply says that when we look at this, we need to look at the FTA and at the customs union. So let's start with the FTA. The 1996 Maseru Protocol envisaged this asymmetrical and differentiated removal of duties on substantial or trade, as I already indicated. SACU undertook to remove duties on more than 95% of tariff lines towards other members of SADC by 2005, and in fact we've done that. Others had to remove duties on less than 80% in some cases, and they had by 2008. Now, when we look at this, there was an audit study which was presented at the Ministerial Task Force and then into the summit, the recent summit in Lusaka. And it was saying, well, where are we in terms of the FTA? Well, there are two countries that actually have not signed the agreement or have made no offer. Rather, one of them is not signed at all, that's the DRC, and the other one has made no offer, is Angola. There were four countries, according to the audit study, that were behind in their current commitments. The commitments that they had to make in terms of removing duties up to 2007. Five countries, the audit study found, had heavily backloaded their obligations. Some of them, I mean, they're different obligations towards SACU and towards others, but some of them will have to, according to the schedules that they submitted, remove duties on more than 50% of their tariff lines next year in order to reach their obligations. So they've done very little over the 7 years, and then all the obligations come in the last year. That was the state of implementation. But in the discussions that emerged and were agreed on in the summit, all countries have nevertheless agreed that when the summit, the SADC summit, takes place in South Africa in round about August next year, that they have all have agreed that the free trade area will be launched next year. So that's the free trade area. As South Africa, we have said we must focus on the work of the free trade area. We have said that we want the existing commitments under the Maseru Protocol to work. That includes all the tariff commitments. But we also think that this must be complemented by a number of real economy cooperation measures, and there is a protocol on industrial policy which has not been tabled, which is still under discussion. It's very general. The Maseru Protocol in fact calls for there to be cooperation on industrial policy. The protocol at the moment that's doing the rounds would actually allow all the industry ministers to determine a series of projects, and we want to see this advance. We also want to see sectoral cooperation advance, as well as some of the non-tariff barriers, trade facilitation, and some of the issues around rules of origin. A consultant's report has been tabled on the options for the SADC Customs Union. It was presented to the task force, and as I said earlier, it will be subject to national consultation. The task team will meet again, it says there, October. That was the decision in Lusaka. I'm told it may be the first week of November. But anyway, within a short space of time, the task force will meet, and we need to have some national consultations on this. What did the consultants... there's an outstanding consultant's report on the implications of differing trade agreements that countries have. But the consultants make a number of points, and I think I just want to give you a bit of a flavor and suggest that parliamentarians might also want to engage more fully in this process. I'm going to put it very blandly and very neutrally, because we still want to consider the government response, but I think we get a flavor of it from what I'm saying. The consultant's report is actually divided into two sections. One is a fairly long analysis, but they were also pushed to make a very specific proposal about what would a SADC common external tariff look like. So the consultants actually point out that there are very few functioning customs unions in the developing world. Many of those that there are in existence are like Mercosur, only partial. The common external tariff only applies to some of the tariff lines, and some tariff lines are set nationally. And many of those, including the EU one, took many, many years to construct and agree on the common external tariff. So the negotiations for the European Union apparently took 11 years before they could reach agreement on the shape of a common external tariff. Now, the consultants reject there were a series of options that were previously discussed for building a customs union in SADC. There were basically two that were contenders. One of them was what was called the variable geometry option. This one says that we actually have within SADC a customs union, which is SACU, South African Customs Union. And what we can do is we can build on SACU, create conditions for new members to join. We could change the relationship of SADC and SACU so SACU would become some sort of a body of SADC. And that we could build on that as the SADC Customs Union. We'd retain the FTA with everybody else. If the others wanted to form some other customers union, they could do that. But the consultants reject that. They say that's shallow, that's not going to advance the objective. And in fact, what they go for is the option of a complete SADC-wide customs union with a completely new common external tariff. Now, they argue that what are the benefits of moving from the free trade area to the customs union? You remember the difference is you in the free trade area you already have free trade on substantial products within your area, but now with the customs union you add the common external tariff. What do they say are the main arguments in favour? Well, they put in two. One is they say that one of the problems of current intra-regional trade is the rules of origin are difficult, and what this means is much intra-regional trade that could take place isn't taking place because of complicated rules of origin. They do acknowledge that you can, within the free trade area framework, and this is already happening, you can simplify the rules of origin. This is happening already. But the main other argument they have is they say that the advantage of a common external tariff will not be that it will generate anything in terms of intra-regional trade, but that it will lock in a new low tariff, it can lock in a new low tariff regime that will integrate the region into the world economy. Now, basically what they say is they say that what countries need, developing countries need, is you need low tariffs towards the outside world, that will integrate you into the world economy. And they have a model which is based on, I think the assumptions are that there are no supply capacity problems, there are no market access problems in the developed world. The market mechanism will bring about a relatively unproblematic adjustment from uncompetitive to competitive industries. And on the basis of this, they say that if SADC adopts a common low tariff, you will lock this into everybody and you will integrate yourself into the world economy. They would like to have made it lower than they actually proposed, but they do acknowledge that there's a revenue problem, that SADC countries are quite dependent on customs duties for revenue collection, and that there is a need to retain something like the current level of revenue collection from customs tariffs. But at the same time, they're quite critical of the SACU revenue sharing formula, and they suggest a simpler, cleaner revenue sharing formula. I'll go into the details if you want, but they suggest an easier, simpler formula for sharing revenue than the current SACU arrangement, but that when they reach their recommendation on what the common external tariff should look like, it's informed by the idea that the overall revenue pool should be roughly the kind of level at the moment. They say that the South African tariff system, which is the SACU system, is too complicated and is too driven, as it is, by industrial policy and trade policy considerations. And they therefore say that you can't, if they don't believe that extending that to other countries would be beneficial. What they propose instead is a simple common external tariff, and I think this is what you must all discuss. They propose zero duties for capital and intermediate goods, and then a flat tariff of 5 to 10% on consumer goods. So the negotiations will be about the range of, we'll have no duties on capital goods, no duties on intermediate goods, and then we'll have between 5 and 10% duties on all consumer goods. That's the proposal. What we are supposed to do is to go back and reflect on that. As government, we want to analyze that and analyze the implications. We also, I think, need to unpack the basis of the model. All of this, by the way, is still, according to the timetable, supposed to happen by the year 2010. But I think we're putting this now for the portfolio committee to take note of, and I think SINDOC is engaging with, because it does amount to a very significant departure for us, and one who whose propositions are, if I could just make a preliminary comment, highly debatable. Let's put it that way. Let me move then on to the SALAC-IPA negotiations, which I think is the third area. This is the negotiation which is taking place between not the whole of SADC, but the what's called the SADC-IPA negotiating configuration, which is some members of SADC and the European Union around something called economic partnership agreements. Now, economic partnership agreements were the EU had non-reciprocal trade preference arrangements with African, Caribbean, and Pacific countries going through Lomé conventions into the current Cotonou agreement. This is to say that it didn't demand that those countries created any trade preferences for the European Union, but it simply offered them trade preferences, better terms of access into the EU market for a range of products from those countries. But the EU has argued consistently, and even against a lot of skepticism from the ACP, it's pushed the idea that it cannot any longer continue with non-reciprocal preferences offered to ACP countries, and that there's a need to move to a WTO-compatible alternative, which will involve the negotiation with different ACP regions. The preferences are available to the ACP as a block. Now it wants to negotiate with different, about six or seven different ACP regions on a reciprocal free trade agreement as one component of these economic partnership agreements. So that's what it's looking for, a free trade agreement, coupled with some fairly vague and non-substantiated promises of additional aid for trade and some other trade-related issues which I'll come back to. That's the process that we're talking about. Now, as I was saying, we're talking about the negotiation not with the whole of SADC, because not all of SADC has chosen to go into the same configuration as far as negotiation with the EU is concerned. Malawi, Mauritius, Zimbabwe, and Zambia have chosen to join the Eastern and Southern Africa group, which is being coordinated by COMESA, the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa. The Democratic Republic of the Congo is in the Central African Monetary something or other community, CEMAC. And in fact, Madagascar, we should put it, Madagascar is also a member of SADC, but it's also in the ESA group. So the SADC group that's negotiating with the EU on the EPA is the SACU countries, South Africa, Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland, and then Angola, Mozambique, and we put it in brackets Tanzania, because Tanzania is also under pressure to join the Eastern African Community, which is another subset of the EFA group. Now, when the EFA negotiations started, it coincided with the review of the existing agreement South Africa has with the European Union, the Trade Development Cooperation Agreement review. And what we proposed, and this was sort of accepted in principle, was that in the interest of promoting regional integration, and particularly harmonizing our relations with the EU among the whole of that SADC group, we should join the EPA process. And that was agreed and adopted by both sides. But we met in Luanda in March 2006, and we adopted a proposal as the SADC EPA group. And we argued that, well, in our area, we have already addressed the question of providing reciprocal benefits to the European Union, because the Trade Development Cooperation Agreement is in place. It's a free trade agreement. We have provided certain openings to the European Union, and those openings to the European Union also apply to Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland, because they are members of the customs union. We said the other countries, Angola, Mozambique, and Tanzania, are all least developed countries. And according to the EU's own rules, they are entitled to duty-free, quota-free access for everything but arms. And we said, therefore, The question of reciprocity in this configuration has all been solved. And that the negotiation should focus on sensitivities of Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland, and in achieving duty-free, quota-free access to the European Union market for all of us in a more harmonized system, and then we should also be addressing issues of development cooperation. We said there should be no binding commitments or obligations on new generation issues, which is trading services plus trade-related matters, which are matters of investment agreements, competition agreements, and transparency in government procurement arrangements. Now, the EU responded a year later. I think we should note this because there's a time clock ticking, but it took a full year for them to respond. They proposed for all of the different EPA negotiating groups that there should be duty-free, quota-free access for all products except sugar, rice, and hey, look at this, competitive products of South Africa. So they're not going to give us everything. But there is a process of negotiation which is taking place in which they're offering us some improvements over what we've got, but of course they want some improvements in terms of what they get into the common SACU market as well. They argued that least developed countries should accept reciprocity. They don't accept that they disagree with our proposal that we don't have to consider reciprocity for Angola, Mozambique, and Tanzania. They said that they must accept reciprocity. The argument was to promote regional coherence. And I think the one hard thing which they've held out on is that although the everything but arms arrangement does provide for duty-free, quota-free access for everything but arms, also rice, sugar, and bananas, but although it does provide that duty-free, quota-free, the rules of origin are quite difficult to comply with, and particularly they don't allow accumulation with inputs from South Africa to define a product as qualified. So they've actually basically said we're not going to address the rules of origin issue in the EPA context. If you want to address the rules of origin issue, you have to go to the EPA context, and the EPA context requires you to make reciprocal obligations. And also they've implicitly held out the idea that further funding that's made available with EPA will be made available to those that participate in the reciprocal thing. The EU has also argued that the EPA process should include negotiation of an agreement on trading services and also new generation issues, there they are, I mentioned them already, as well as labour and environmental standards, as well as intellectual property. But in intellectual property, they really mean geographic indications. Those are names for geographic products, you know, the old port and sherry issue that we confronted with them in the TDCA negotiation. They said all of this must be completed by December this year. Think comes in March, must be completed by December this year, because the EU went to the ACP in Doha, in fact, and called for an extension of the waiver for the quarterly preferences, and that waiver expires in December this year. And the EU has said it's not interested in going back to ask for another waiver, and it says that, if there's no agreement, it says it will have no other possibility other than to simply withdraw those preferences at the end of the year. If there's nothing else negotiated in place, then ACP countries will trade on GSP, the General System of Preference terms, and basically these are worse conditions than they currently enjoy. So they threaten that if there's no more conclusion by the end of the year, then all these countries will trade on worse terms. I'll come back to those and some critiques of those in a minute. Now, where does this process stand? We made some progress at technical level on trading goods. I already mentioned this. The EU's offered, although it's not going to give us duty-free, quota-free, it's offering to improve access for South Africa, but it wants some improved access in return. It's also the BLMS sensitivities. Those countries were invited to say what are the sensitive products. They've identified some. Mostly they're asking for tariffs to be frozen at the current levels, but in one or two cases they're asking for tariff increases. The EU is very reluctant to see any of this. It says that this would be a rollback. There is a debate, and I don't want to give everything's rosy on the trading goods, but there's a hard negotiation taking place, but we think a manageable negotiation. There's huge pressure on Angola, Mozambique, and Tanzania. I don't want to speak for them. I just want to say there's huge pressure on them, as well as least developed countries in other regions, to reciprocate, to abandon their claims for non-reciprocity. And here we come up with the issue of the relationship with the WTO and the bilateral process. In the WTO, there has been a degree of agreement that there should be duty-free, quota-free access on a non-reciprocal basis for products from least developed countries in developed country markets, and there's also and some developing countries, advanced developing countries as well. That's the sort of, there's that negotiation going on. But here, in this negotiation, they're under pressure to abandon those ambitions and to reciprocate. The most difficult issues for us are the issues of trading services and trade-related issues. Now, although these are presented as measures to enhance the region as an investment destination, the EU has argued that we need to have an agreement which may not conclude at the end of 2007, but we must take upfront commitments to conclude an agreement on substantive matters of trading services and also trade-related issues. And they say we must do this because this is what modern regions that are well integrated into the world economy will have in place. They will have in place competition laws, they will have in place investment protection agreements and so on. But in actual fact, we have in SADC, we have no common position on any of these issues, not even in SADC. We're very far from that. And if we look at the EU's own history, these things only emerged at a fairly late stage of the EU's own integration process. So we don't... Well, let me put it personally. I don't buy the argument that the EU is trying to press us to make these commitments because they are interested in promoting regional integration. It's got very little to do with that. It's got much more to do with the fact that the EU has drafted position papers, one of them which is called Global Europe, in which it has identified a number of critical beyond-the-tariff issues. Remember I was mentioning early on that when tariffs come down or subsidies come down, then other issues, other regulations become important. In the case of developing countries, it's standards. In the case of developed countries, what they want is they want investment protection agreements, competition law, and so on. Not just that we reach an agreement on those, because they presented a text in Walfish Bay. And let's take the example of competition. They want our competition authorities within a period of square brackets 5 years to be intervening against domestic monopolies on behalf of European potential investors. That's the sort of thing that they want. And we have actually come up and said we are not interested, and particularly South Africa, we are not interested in any binding commitments on these new generation issues. We are prepared to discuss with them cooperation to enhance capacity in these areas, but we are not prepared to take on board binding commitments in these kind of areas. So the SADC EPA common position is that we agree to cooperation with the view to building capacity, but no binding commitments, and we don't want these commitments subject to dispute settlement arrangements under the EPA process. I mean, the equivalent of us agreeing to what they want on, say, competition, would be that every time the EU wants to introduce a new standards law, we have to be consulted on that, we have to make our representation, and then if we disagree with what they're coming up with, then we bring it into the SADC EPA Council, and we then that will make a ruling. And we're not prepared to have one half of that without the other half of that. And I think that's basically where our position is. But inordinate pressure on other members of our grouping with the threat that if we don't buckle in on these issues, then the 2007 deadline will pass and that everybody will be trading on worse terms with the EU, and also with pressure on countries in other areas. And as I point out here, the EU wants some firm commitment to negotiate binding commitments in a later ESA phase, with upfront commitments from South Africa, particularly in services. And this is a really sticky issue for us. And then, pointing out there at the end there, the end date is looming. But although December 2007 sees the waiver expire, we are not convinced that if the waiver expires in 2007, that this automatically means that the EU has to stop applying the current Cotonou preferences. Our view is that, what happens is that those Cotonou preferences are not something which is just there out of political goodwill on the EU. It's actually a contractual obligation through the Cotonou Agreement. And that it would only have to stop applying them if some other WTO member went to the WTO and got a ruling from the WTO to stop applying those. And in fact, there's been a legal text which the Commonwealth Secretariat has produced, which argues that. So that's to give you some idea of some of the issues around that. I mean, I'm sure you've got much more important things to do with internet gambling and so on. So I don't know, Chairperson. But perhaps I'll stop at that point.
Thank you very much, Comrade Kopp. I'll take comments, questions now. I've noted you, Dr. Ravi, Comrade Dali.
Sorry, I don't know. Maybe we're going to talk about NEPA.
In the interest of time, we could prepare a briefing, because I think these are probably the more pressing issues, and given the time constraints, we will prepare a briefing on NEPAD and IPSA, if that helps your time.
That's fine, then. But if you wanted to make just overarching comments, you may do so. But if you rather we do it some other time, fine.
I'm in your hands. Just really on the question of time. I can make very briefly a couple of points on that part of it.
I'm saying that make your brief comments, and then we'll bear it in mind that we might not have all the time to go into that aspect, but just to flag the relevant issues now, so that next time we meet there's a background.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think just to give a very brief update on our NEPAD work, I think the NEPAD work and the work on this are qualitatively different to the kind of negotiating process that the Deputy Minister has outlined. The work on NEPAD is really built around the work program that has as the overall objective continental integration and development, and in particular promoting intra-Africa trade. On the economic aspects of the NEPAD, there's a focus on ICT, infrastructure, tourism, SMME, and better coordination amongst African countries on that. And within that frame, the DTI's particular focus has been on work around promoting intra-Africa trade and SMME development. The key areas of work that we've been involved in over the course of the last year has been to try to find ways of raising the profile of NEPAD in South Africa. Although it's an important program of work for government, it's probably not very widely known and understood in South Africa. So some of the work has been to try to raise the profile by establishing projects in South Africa that relate to the NEPAD objectives.
The second important area of work for NAPPART is there are a number of projects that have been identified, infrastructure projects that require investment, and so there are a series of conferences that are held over the course of each year, the objective of which is to try to profile NAPPART projects to international investors and get them to buy in. So that's another area of work that's going on. I think the key issue for us there is we're needing to reevaluate some of those processes to see actually whether or not they're actually delivering on their objectives. So there is something of a review of how we approach that part of the work. The third area that the department's been involved in over the course of this year is that we've coordinated the DTI's input into the APRM, the African Peer Review Mechanism. The focus has been on work that is done with respect to corporate governance and regional integration. And we've coordinated our input into that process. What arose out of that is a program of action over the next year, and we would be focused mainly those two areas from a DTI perspective on corporate governance and regional integration. I think there's quite an important conference that's coming up that's also taken up sort of in the broad framework. There's an important conference of African ministers of industry to be held in September this year. And essentially, it's the first discussion of amongst African ministers on how to promote industrial development in Africa. And so there'll be some sharing of experiences, and I think South Africa, given where we've come on our industrial policy processes, has a particular role to play and to share that experience with other countries. The final area of work which is ongoing is to try to strengthen intra-governmental coordination around NAPPART. Different departments are involved in different aspects of the NAPPART program. It's not always optimally coordinated, and so there's some discussion that's underway on how to strengthen that. And from the DTI's point of view, our particular focus is how we provide support to the NAPPART Secretariat, which is based in South Africa, how we provide more effective technical support to the unit, to the Secretariat. So this is ongoing work. With respect to IPSA, IPSA is an important forum. I think it's still in its early days in many respects, but it's made significant advances with respect to South Africa, India, and Brazil coordinating their positions on a number of important global issues that arise in the UN, on the WTO, to the extent that they do, that those issues come up, issues of terrorism, migration, a range of issues that are really the preserve of the Department of Foreign Affairs. Department of Foreign Affairs leads our engagement in IPSA. So that's a kind of coordination on a range of global issues which I would say probably has made the most significant advances in the IPSA process. There are also a range of sectoral working groups that have been established, and some of which have memoranda of understanding to coordinate work between the three governments in specific areas. The science and technology, transport departments, our respective departments of transport, science and technology, energy, customs, meet under the IPSA umbrella and try to coordinate their work on that. The DTI for our part, we are responsible for the subcommittee on trade and investment that also reports into this into the broader IPSA process. And there's essentially four key elements of the work program on the trade and investment subcommittee. The first is I think it's quite an important one in the sense that it is an attempt to build on what is already underway between the three countries. in terms of establishing trade arrangements. We're very close to concluding an agreement between SACU and Mercosur to open up trade between SACU and Mercosur. We have hopefully one or two more meetings before the end of this year to conclude that negotiation. Mercosur and India have concluded their negotiation on a preferential trade agreement. In September or early October this year, we will launch a negotiation between SACU and India for a preferential trade agreement between us. What we're trying to do is use this as a basis to build a trilateral trade agreement between SACU, Mercosur, and India. So the discussions that we're having now under this item in IPSA is what would be the framework, what would be the modalities, what would be the challenges in trying to get this trilateral trade arrangement off the ground once the other bilateral pillars are in place. I think what's important about this, I mean, for us in terms of going forward, is that we were aiming to conclude the Mercosur this year, and that we're looking to launch the SACU India negotiations this year. The second area of work is with respect to technical barriers to trade. I think the Deputy Minister is making the same reference. These are some of the more intractable barriers to trade. Tariffs can be negotiated, but technical barriers to trade are particularly intractable and difficult to address. And so we thought that a dedicated committee, dedicated work program around this, looking to open up trade between the three countries, is quite important. The third area of work is a comparison of national experiences and best practices with respect to SMME development. India and Brazil have had some successes in this. South Africa has some successes in this. But there is an understanding that through more cooperation in this area, we could benefit from that shared experience. The final area that the DTI is responsible for is for coordinating the business participation in IPSA. So we interact with business, try to define a work program with business whereby they would interact with their counterparts in Brazil and India. Probably what's quite important, just in terms of timing, is that there would be a summit to be held in South Africa in October this year. The summit of heads of state. We last month there was a ministerial preparatory meeting in India. The follow-up, that is the preparation for the summit. At the summit, we would need to report progress in all of these areas. And for DTI in particular, it would be around the trade arrangement, technical barriers to trade, SMME, and the business participation. So we've got the work program on all of that for October.
Thank you very much. That gives us a very broad and dense overview. We go back to comments and questions. Dr. Ravi.
Thank you, Chairman. My question has been partially covered by Mr. Khalil, and it relates to Mercosur. I just want to ask the Deputy Minister, Dr. Davies. Dr. Davies, you mentioned when it comes to duty-free and quota-free imports, the EU said that they exclude a number of competitive products, South African competitive products. Now, can you give us examples of these competitive products? I'd really appreciate that. Thank you, Chairman.
Thanks, Dr. Ravi. Could you kindly switch off your mic?
Sorry.
Comrade.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. My first question in relation to the slide which deals with the fact that two countries not signed or made no offer. I just want to check in relation to our involvement in particular DRC. Because if you look at our involvement there, we are in terms of this RDP approach in DRC. So what is our sort of view in terms of maybe persuading them or cooperating with them to say they must also confine with the rules of the game? Secondly, you referred to Angola. In terms of Angola, I would just say that maybe we've lost an opportunity after the fall of UNITA there. Because it seems to me there's not much work that we're doing in Angola at all. Maybe I just want to quickly hear your views around that. That country is rich of oil and diamonds. It seems we are not really tapping anything in that particular area. The other issue, Chair, is in relation to, I think, page 7 of the slide, which talks about the SADC cooperation. That it seems to me that no common position within the SADC country. I'm raising this issue in the view of what we call the United States of Africa. We took a view that we need to develop the regional economies before we go to that route. If within among the regional economies there is no cooperation and common view, how far then can we take this process to that particular ultimate goal? As you have correctly said here, that these other three countries, they decided to join ISA instead of the other structure. The last issue, of course, maybe it may comment in terms of the page 8, that within the negotiations that the EU, they are saying, accept sugar and rice and commodity products from South Africa. I don't know, because it seems to me the agriculture has always come up as a focus point, where agriculture is always an issue, where they say, no, we don't touch that, becomes a hot potato and all those things. The last case on page 9, which is relating to the inquiry of what are the prospects in terms of meeting that deadline. As you are correctly saying, that if you didn't meet that deadline, then there are serious implications in terms of that. What are the prospects? And what would be the alternative if you don't meet that particular deadline in order you to avoid this worst term within the EU in particular? Thank you.
Thanks, Rob Chirok.
Yeah, I think we should be very appreciative of the very frank presentation by the Deputy Minister, filling us in on the, in a way, background to the negotiations as well as the content. I found it a rather gloomy picture, and it seems to me that this committee might at some stage have a look at what we're saying about globalization as a whole, because these negotiations are the real nitty-gritty of globalization. And the propaganda that is put out about challenges and opportunities is actually belied by the story we were given this morning, and I think we ought to take account of that. The situation is not as favorable in the relationship between US and Europe, particularly Europe, with us, as is often presented, and I think that anyway, I've said it. I think it also leads us to the point that Rob made about political interventions in the US by Congress. He's made this point before. And it seems to me this committee ought to take seriously the question of how we deal with these matters. We can't leave it alone to the minister. Parliament has to have a say. And I think that this is an opportunity for us to have a debate in the House and to come together, come with a position on these matters of what sort of political interventions are required by South Africa in backing up our negotiators. The other point I'd like to make is that what is clear is that there's an enormous amount of discussion, an enormous amount of negotiation. What I would like to hear much more about is what are the real changes taking place. Because the more one reads the literature about these discussions, and David Lally's point about the fragmentation of effort and the multiplicity of organizations, it's clear there's an awful lot of disagreement, an awful lot of discussion, but how much actual real change is taking place on the ground to integrate the region? That's the question we would be interested in this committee. So I think we would like to get a sort of update on actual changes which are taking place as a result of the discussions, and not so much about the discussions and the difficulties, although obviously I welcome very much the briefing. Last point is on NEPAD. I still cannot understand why the question of NEPAD is shared between Foreign Affairs and DTI. Clearly, the whole ethos of NEPAD is a socio-economic framework. It's not, and they've said again and again, while projects are okay and projects are necessary, but it's the framework which is vital for NEPAD. And you cannot have a framework implemented in a country if you've got a division of labor between different ministries. And I cannot understand why we don't have, to use a cliche, one center of power around MedMed. And I wish the DTI and Foreign Affairs would come to an agreement. And just in case you don't know, the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs gave an extended briefing to the Foreign Affairs Committee 2 weeks ago. I have a document that she presented, including a whole lot of detail about how MedMed is being handled across Africa and in the region. And there again, its intentions and its meetings, but not actually what's happening as a result of this very important initiative by the head of state of Africa, our MedMed. Thanks.
Thank you, Comrade Frank. Comrade Chisa?
Thanks, Ted. I have a few questions first before I make an input there. Let me also echo my appreciation of the inputs that have been made by the Deputy Minister and Mr. Xavier. One is really beginning to appreciate that this is a very complex area, particularly when you shuttle between South Africa and Geneva. We get input from you, and when you pay our Geneva office, we're also getting another bombardment and really have a clear idea of the enormous challenges that we're facing. Chair, one is keen to know as to with regard to the SADC EU EPA, reference is made to the fact that there's pressure to conclude the current round of negotiations by the end of the year. One would like to know is what impact, in any case, would that have on the Doha round? One understands that the EPA is separate, but still, the very players within the SADC EU EPA negotiations are also players within in WTO. Beyond this, I just have a couple of formal suggestions to put forward. Assuming that that's one of the things that the DTI and us as a portfolio committee would like to look into. Well, first of all, is that whilst we may get an input now, the unfortunate thing is that already there are other role players waiting and intimidating to make an input afterwards. And my assumption was that we would have a feast of the day just to look at international relations. And on that basis, it might be helpful that if we have another round, we do it through the form of a comprehensive workshop on international trade in general. But what one proposes is that it would be helpful if we can have an emphasis on the parliamentary perspective when it comes to international trade. Because time and again, it comes up that there are certain legislators in other countries that really take a very much active and a robust role on international trade. The second area is that of providing support to DTI and also playing our role in the oversight role in particular. Just to reinforce what Professor Turoga is saying, to me, maybe it might be helpful to explore whether we shouldn't call that a trade promotion framework, so that from time to time we could look at what do we include in that framework within which DTI would be able to interact, whether it's international trade, but specifically WTO. But once again, the idea would be to ensure that we, amongst other things, get advice from like-minded parliaments who have already been on the road for some time. I understand that there's pressure from Europe on the EPA, but it would be helpful if, through SADC Parliamentary Forum, we could also approach our very colleagues in the Parliament of Europe, either to try and get an end meeting or just send a letter of concern as to how the executives, if I can say, are negotiating, and rather and not and come some way, particularly the pressure that should the negotiations not be concluded by the end of the year, some of the issues that are favorable to us, particularly the least developing countries, would fall off. The mention has been made of the Portfolio Committee for Foreign Affairs. I would formally raise that we should actually join the to approach the Portfolio Committee, particularly to look at the issue of Nepal as well as IFSA. I mean, with IFSA we play an economic, trade and investment role, but with Nepal, I want to repeat, Professor Turok has argued very strongly on that. Another area is, but still with reference to the Nepal initiative, one of the things is I would propose we lift up and highlight and strengthen very strongly is the what I regard as a campaign for demarginalization of Africa. Our Minister of Foreign Affairs, has been highlighting this in her speeches time and again that Africa is marginalized. And I think it's a conscious effort now. It's not that maybe it's not one or another integrated or indirectly referred to in our work, but is to make sure that there's a very conscious effort that what we're doing, in a global level, that we're actually demarginalizing Africa. The last point is that time and again, when one went to Geneva, comparing the various missions there, it has actually been disconcerting about our status of our mission there, the WHO mission. And I would propose that maybe the DTI should consider exploring and upgrading of the status of our mission to equal to the other missions from other countries. At this stage in time, because Zambia can articulate that, it's lower than the other missions, and I don't think that they augurs well, particularly with the significance and the profile that South Africa enjoys. I thank you.
Comrade Sitara, thank you. Comrade Hassan, you are next.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I would like to find out about who would benefit between the EU and SADC on IPA, who stands to benefit. Because already we are negotiating at the level of the WTO, right? And EU tends to be a stumbling block together with US at that level. And at the same time, it jumps over to certain regions like SADC to negotiate on other issues that are part and parcel of negotiations at the level of WTO. So, if those negotiations go through, who stands to benefit, EU or ourselves? The second one would be, why IPA negotiations before we are fully integrated, the SADC? We have completed the negotiation for integration. Why do you go beyond this integration before you integrated, you begin negotiations with the EU? Of course, even in the presentation you have raised that some of the issues raises contradiction on questions of reciprocity, which questions are also addressed at the level of the WTO. The last question would be, there's a view that South Africa, in particular, through SWACO, is already benefiting in terms of the trade relations that it enjoys with the EU. Already it does help those agreements that it enjoys with EU and the trade relations, why in the negotiations has it been pressured to be part of and parcel of this negotiation on IPA? Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Hassman. Perhaps just to add to the comments and questions that members have made, just to ask about Mr. Faisal Ismail. I remember some time ago, some years ago, there was a discussion between the Department of Trade and Industry and Foreign Affairs to ensure that he has the status of an ambassador. And if memory serves me correct, that would enable him to engage with other trade ambassadors at the highest level, whereas presently, perhaps technically, that is not the case. So if an answer can be given today, but it would be something that we'd like an answer on in the future, because this thing has been for years. Thank you.
No, thanks, and I'll try to respond to some of the questions and leave some to David. And I just want to say that all the various proposals that have been made about workshops or raising the game, I just want to encourage those. I'm not going to comment in detail on those proposals.
Because I think that, and
maybe it's also to respond to Prof. Turok's observation, because I don't think that we are very well served in our national discourse on international trade matters. I mean, where there's reportage on international trade matters, you know, we often hear the opinions of other parties. We don't very often look at the issues from our own point of view and the impact it can have on our people and our prospects for growth and development and stuff like that. And very often these matters are actually marginalized compared to other matters which we're dealing with as a department, let's say, things of that sort. Whereas actually, if you look at these, start to unpack these things, I mean, the way these negotiations, these three or four negotiations unfold in the next 3 or 4 months is actually going to have very, very critical implications in terms of our long prospects for trade promotion. And if we look at our situation as it stands now, we do badly need as a country to increase our exports of value-added products. We do need to do that. We also need to achieve a situation in the region where the imbalance in trade which we have between ourselves and the rest of the region is begins to be corrected or begins to be narrowed. So I think that these matters that we're discussing now are actually rather critical matters, but under-noticed matters in our national discussion. So whatever this committee can do to raise the awareness of these matters, I think I would welcome very much. Dr. Ravi's question, in terms of the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, broadly speaking, we got access on most industrial products. I think there's a few lines of aluminium products or things of that sort where there's some difficulties. We're into the EU market. Industrial products, they basically opened up to us. Where they didn't open up to us, we're on agricultural products. On some they did, on some they didn't. But the products where they are sensitive towards us are mostly in the agricultural area. Now, there are, as I said before, I mean, maybe Xavier will want to add when he speaks, but there are some lines of agricultural products where they have indicated that they are prepared to improve on the current Trade and Cooperation Agreement access. Some of those actually I believe are lines where we don't actually produce much at the moment. But that's the nature of the game. And as I said earlier on, they want something in return. They want improved access into the South African market in return. I mean, I think one of the things is that if somebody comes along and tells you that they're a rich, developed part of the world and they want to come and help you to develop, I think we need to understand that sentiment doesn't actually play very much role when we start getting to the nitty-gritty of actual details of trade negotiations. Trade negotiations are hard give and take, hard bargaining. That's what they are. And I think that if we go into processes and we believe that someone's coming along there to help us do this and that and the other thing, and they've got no vested mercantilist interest, I think we're making a big mistake. So, I think that's the process that we're involved in the EU, and I think we accept it for what it is. It's give and take. We made a push for coherence in the region. If they were really we're going to prioritize coherence in the region over the interests of sectors in Europe which would face a bit of competition from us, then they would give us duty-free quota free. The fact that they don't, I think, also says speak volumes about how trade negotiations work out. On the question of the DRC, I don't know where the DRC is at. I don't know where Xavier knows in terms of accession to the SADC trade protocol. Angola indicated that they would be making an offer before the end of the year. So Angola has signed the protocol but has not made an offer. And they said they would do one before the end of the year. They have called for understanding because of reconstruction after the war and all that kind of stuff. But they've indicated that they will be on board for the launch of the FTA next year. I mean, South Africa has a fairly significant bilateral relationship with Angola. There's quite a growing trade. I think people are also quite aware of some of the construction and other opportunities in Angola. We do. I don't think that we're not aware of that. I'm sure there's more we could be doing with Angola, but I think that bilaterally we are pursuing some of these issues. I think the issue that David Lally is raising about the SADC cooperation agenda, how it relates to the United States of Africa, all of that, I think these are absolutely fundamental issues. We're doing some work on this, and at some stage, you know, maybe we'll be able to come and share some of this. But I think, broadly speaking, I think when we look at the integration agenda and the way it's informed, what theory underlies this? You know, John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist, made this famous statement. He said, practical men, and he was writing in the 1930s when gender equality wasn't recognized, practical men who imagine that they are under no intellectual influence are usually the slave of some defunct economist. That's what he said. And the one in question in this is Jacob Viner. And Jacob Viner had this linear succession. You go from FTAs, you go to customs unions, you go to common markets. It's broadly speaking what's informed the EU. But Viner actually also said that this process works well where you have complementarity, where countries produce goods that the other ones can import. And there's a whole literature that says in developing regions those conditions don't exist. And that in developing regions, the approach towards building regions should actually focus to a greater extent on issues of practical, real economy, cooperation, coordination of policies, and addressing a number of real economy constraints. And that should be the basis on which you make movements up these ladders. So, I mean, our position is that we want to see this FTA, as we agreed it in 1996, function, together with the things that are necessary to make the FTA work properly and to address imbalances, which are things like elements of cooperation around industrial policy, things like advancing agendas of sectoral programs. For example, we have a number of bilateral spatial development initiatives with a number of countries, but they operate bilaterally. We want to see those things operate much more effectively through the mechanisms of our regional organization, SADC, and so on. I don't want to kind of preempt the debate, but whether we should be making a jump to a customs union anytime soon, when we're not doing all of this, is a real debate that we should be having. And I think we need to have that debate and have it really thoroughly and rigorously. And if we don't follow a mechanical movement in the regional economic communities up that level, then what do we do about a common African program? Can we sit around when the EU is negotiating free trade agreements with West Africa, with Central Africa and everybody else? Can we just sit around here and just wait for those free trade agreements to come into place and then find ourselves as Southern Africa trading on worse terms with West Africa than the EU is? Or should we be actually be trying to promote some kind of continental free trade agreement through relationships between regional economic communities and other regional economic communities? I think these are all debates that we need to have, and we need to engage quite thoroughly and rigorously with a strategy to promote a regional integration. The prospect to meet the deadline of 2007. Well, I think we've been saying, I said repeatedly, that from our point of view, although we've got many issues that we need to resolve, we think that we can in fact reach a trading goods agreement by the end of the year. We can reach an agreement on trading goods, which includes fishery products and all of those things. And we will negotiate an agreement. We can conclude this by the end of this year. We think that the difficulties will arise if the EU continues to try to push the new generation issue. And if we don't reach an agreement on all elements, then presumably then they will start to say, well, we haven't reached an agreement, the waiver has expired. I already said that I don't think that the moment the waiver expires means that the EU has got the right to withdraw the preferences, because those are a legal agreement, and it would only be when the WTO rules on that, if somebody goes to the WTO and gets a ruling on that. But and that's the legal opinion of the Commonwealth. But I think that there is some discussion taking place, and I think this is where a point about engaging with European parliamentarians and so on would be useful. There's a discussion taking place behind the scenes about Plan B. Because I think that there are voices and influential people in Europe who begin to realize that this thing is going to end up with a train smash. Come a few months' time, there'll be a train smash. That suddenly there will be the European Union sitting without an agreement with not just us, but with the other EPA regions. And that they do need Plan B in place to avoid that outcome. And I think whatever conversations we can have with European parliamentarians, the influential debates and so on, to try to get some sense of what's doable. If we have a trading goods agreement with the EU, trade and cooperation agreement, it took us years to negotiate the level of reciprocity which we were comfortable with the EU. If we just start talking about trading services or something like that, it's not going to happen in any substantial way in a few months. So I think that that sort of thing would be quite important. I'll leave the questions about DTI and EFA and NEPA, and I'll leave those to Xavier. Are these things all linked? Well, yeah, I think they are all linked. I think that was Peter's question. And particularly you're saying about the Doha and the SADC EPA. I mentioned a couple of links. If these developed countries are forced in the EPA process to give up their claims as least developed countries for duty-free, quota-free, non-reciprocal access, in the EPA context, what's this going to mean for their positions in the Doha round? I think these are all kinds of issues that are coming up. As you probably know, in Cancun, the issues of trade-related matters that the EU was pushing for to include the multilateral process, they were kicked off the agenda, basically, the so-called Singapore issues. Now we see them reoccurring here in the bilateral context and in the EPA process. So I think there's a link between all of those. Whatever choices we make on regional integration are going to impact on the lineup of SADC. Already the EPA process has created a division within SADC. So I think all of these things are actually quite linked. And the point I made at the beginning, I think, how they all work out are actually quite critical. Our own view, and we were trying to work on this in a similar way to the way we worked on industrial policy. We're trying to do some work on, and Xavier will talk about this perhaps a little, a trade policy position. And our own kind of trade policy positions are as the industrial policy indicated. We want industrial policy to shape our trade policy. So what we are discovering through, what comes up through self-discovery processes around sectors
that has an impact on tariff positions, what tariff positions we need to defend. Sometimes it does. It means, you know, if we favor in downstream industries or upstream industries, maybe we're looking for tariff reductions, which is what happened in the steel industry. We want our positions on tariffs to be driven by this to a greater degree. But of course, you know, we're in processes that involve others. Who would benefit from the EU's FENEC process? Well, I mean, I think those are things which are determined in the outcome of the negotiations. Potentially, that will be, you know, we'll get something, and we'll get something. I mean, I think that's what it'll amount to. And then we have to capitalize on what we get through trade promotion. I'm not going to go into issue of Faisal Ismail as ambassador, but I just do want to say that I think we owe an enormous debt of gratitude as a country to Faisal. And I think he's been absolutely sterling work there in the WTO. He's got an enormous amount of respect. The position that I told you about, the group of 101 countries, the G90 plus the NAMRA 11, Faisal did an enormous amount of work around that. Which has put up a very serious marker that developing countries are not prepared to see a development round turned into a market accessing developing countries round. We're not prepared to see that. And I think that I just want to pay enormous tribute to the work that Faisal's doing to say that I think as a country we are great at debt of gratitude. Over to you, Damien.
Just to underline a couple of points. The main access problems we have into the EU market, the Deputy Minister has indicated, are in agriculture. There are only six lines where at the end of the implementation period of the TDCA, the agreement we have with the EU, there are six lines in aluminum under industrial products where we don't have full access. Over the period of the full implementation, which ends in 2010 and 12, we would have full access on industrial, except those six lines on aluminum. There are probably around 300 or so lines, tariff lines in agriculture that we don't have access into the EU market, of which there are probably only around 10 lines that are important to South Africa. It would be sugar, it would be flowers, canned fruit, oranges, wine, grapes, pears, and fish. If we were able to deal with that, they would probably account for around 80% of our interest in agriculture in the EU market. And that's what the current negotiation is about, trying to open up the EU market in those areas. Clearly, the EU wants to, reciprocally wants to get that access into not the South African market, the SACU market. But that's what the negotiations are about. If we can get it to make progress on that, we would need to give something in return, and I think that's where we are. I think the second point I just wanted to underline that the question Professor Turok raised about what's happening on the ground in SADC. I mean, a lot could be said about that, but probably the essential issue is that despite the trade liberalization process under the SADC trade protocol since it's been implemented since 2000, the trade imbalance hasn't changed. It remains in South Africa's favor, around 7-1. And although South Africa and the Deputy Minister presented this, although South Africa and SACU had opened its market for up to 95% of tariff lines to the rest of SADC, the SADC, those SADC partners haven't been able to take advantage of that. And what it points to is the lack of productive supply capacity in the region. Which means then that the issues of regional integration, again, as the Deputy Minister is saying, are not about tariff liberalization or moving to a customs union. It's about building supply capacity in the region to supply the South African market, to build some capacity. If we look at the trade figures, they have remained static. The only increases are in commodity imports from the region.
copper from Zambia, basic agricultural products from Zambia. So that is the real challenge in SADC. And I think the work going forward probably needs to shift much more to looking at those points. The question about NEPAD and the kind of center of power, I think this is the type of discussion, or center decision making, I think this is the type of discussion that is being discussed now in departments. It is the DPSA that provides overall coordination on that. And I mean, there is some justification to it because the NEPAD program is a very broad program, and the competencies that are required to support that are spread across government. So you do need different government departments to participate, but the issue is really around how you coordinate that. You coordinate that effectively. I think the other questions the Deputy Minister answered, I don't think I should take up any more time. Sorry, Chair, just to endorse the point that the Deputy Minister has made about Bagel Ismail's role in Geneva.
Yes, you see, I would also like to come back to that point. I think we are all agreed on that point, that Faisal is doing a good job. I hear the Deputy Minister saying that he's not answering that, or he's not in a position to answer. Then the next question, to whom do I pose this? Do I pose the question to the Minister for a question in the House, or the next time we see, or do I pose the question to the President?
Problem is we don't see him.
We don't see who?
The Minister.
Oh. Okay. But I'm merely saying that it's something that I'm going to raise. We can't just say that somebody's doing spelling work. And between the two departments, I don't get the sense that there's a resolution on this issue. So I'm merely saying that I'm not leaving it here. Good folks.
Yes. Sorry,
sir. I'll indulge you, but I want to move on.
Yeah, I know, Kaban, because of the time and the other group coming. I thought that Mr. Deputy Minister would respond to what I was suggesting, even though it would be a portfolio committee's, initiative as Parliament to link up with the Parliament of Europe, whether he sees that as an initiative that would reinforce our position in the EPA negotiations. I know, as I think, it should be done by the legislature, but to reinforce what executive is doing, already doing. Thanks.
Comrade Sousa, he has responded to that. And we have had meetings with the European Parliament earlier this year, so it means continuing with that. And if there are other aspects where the department can play a role, we'll engage them on that. So, for now, it's a matter that we'll come back to Deputy Minister Davis. Good folks, I would like to suggest that we have a 10-minute body break. Unfortunately, I'm told by the committee clerk that we have run out of budget. So I can't offer you but the past 12 years has not done that. Good folks, welcome once again to all the good people from the department. We continue to slog on this gambling amendment, but the last time we met, you had started the process of walking us through the aspects. So we'll continue doing that. We are in your able hands, good folks.
Thank you very much, Chair and the honorable members of the committee.
what we would want to propose today, there is a document that has been made available to the members of the committee, and we will want to focus on those matters or issues which will result in certain changes or amendments to the bill. There are other aspects which are of a general matter.
For ease of exposition, can you just refer to the title of the document concerned? Because we have several. So just tell us which one you are referring to make it easier.
Thank you, Chair. The document that I'm referring to is entitled Comments on Gambling Amendment Bill, August 2007. There is no date on, unfortunately. But yeah, this is the document that I'm referring to. And I will start off if we can turn to page 9 of that document. And I would want to start off by addressing the matter concerning the policy rationale of this amendment bill. And the committee suggested last time that we should come up with a clear statement as to the intent and purpose of this amendment bill. And Chair, we are proposing, if you look at our comments on Long Tiger, we are proposing to amend the Long Tiger so that it states clearly that the purpose of this bill really is to regulate and to curtail interactive gambling in order to protect society against the overstimulation of the demand for gambling, and also to deal with matters such as the prevention of money laundering and the protection of minors. Chair, we also propose to deal with this aspect in the purpose section of the bill. If you look at page 4 of the actual bill, amendment bill, page 4, section 4 talks about the purpose of the act. We propose to also do some bit of tweaking of some of those objectives or purposes so that it is clear what the intention is. And we are saying that the intention is to control, the intention is to curtail, the intention is to regulate interactive gambling so that we protect certain sections of the population. Here we are therefore proposing to deal to amend those particular sections of the bill. Firstly, the long title, and then secondly, section 4 of the bill. The next issue, which is the last which is rightly below the long title, it says clause 16D, still on page 9, and this deals with restrictions on advertising. One of the issues that came up during our discussions is that in order for us really to contribute towards the purpose of controlling or reducing gambling, we therefore have to deal with the issue around advertising. And we are proposing to restrict or to prohibit advertising by service providers of interactive gambling. And we therefore suggest that if we amend clause 15B to restrict or prohibit the advertising and promotion of interactive gambling, we will in a sense therefore contribute
or rather, yeah, contribute towards the achievement of that particular objective of controlling or containing interactive gambling. So that's the second amendment that we are proposing to the committee. That is clause 15B of the bill to prohibit the advertising and promotion of interactive gambling. But here you will note that in the main act, act number 7 of 2004, advertising of other forms of gambling is allowed, however, within certain conditions and prescripts. So we are suggesting that perhaps we would have to also amend that particular section of the act. However, we would have to go through a consultation process, and therefore at this stage we are only proposing to prohibit advertising on interactive gambling and not the other forms, because we will then have to go back to the principal act and then go through a consultative process in order to effect those changes with regards to other forms of gambling.
Chair, if I may continue and take you to page 11. At the top of the page, it says illegal advertising in South Africa by foreign jurisdictions under the comment column. This advertising, we are extending it to foreign-based service providers to say any form of advertising on interactive gambling is prohibited or forbidden, whether by local providers or by outside service providers. So therefore, nobody is allowed to advertise interactive gambling in South Africa. And here I must just mention the fact that actually currently there is a lot of advertising that goes on in various mediums of communication. Okay, the fourth issue is on page 8. The second matter from the bottom, in the column, in the comment column, it says the DCI's initial agreement with FIC on prevention of money laundering. One of the proposals that came from the committee was that we should meet with the Financial Intelligence Center officials to reach an agreement around this particular bill. Chair, we have received a letter from the FIC. We did meet with them on Monday, and they have written a letter to our parliamentary officer with certain proposals to be included or to tighten certain provisions that are contained in the bill. And we have agreed that we will take those proposals on board. The issues that are already contained in the bill, however, they would want us to tighten or to strengthen those provisions which deal with money laundering. And we will agree that we will take those comments on board. Therefore, we will be making amendments to sections that deal with money laundering. And those will essentially be section 11 and others. Chair, the next issue which we are proposing an amendment on is contained on page 6, and that is age verification. Again, flowing from our discussion with the FIC as well as proposals from members of the committee, we will tighten the provisions regarding age verification so as to place the responsibility on the service provider to age verify players before they can participate in the gambling activity. And, Chair, if you would allow me, the next issue is still on page 6 and deals with the exclusion of person-to-person betting exchanges. And at this point, I want to request our legal advisor to deal with this particular matter. I must say, Chair, that this has been one of the most difficult issues to resolve. However, I'll request our legal advisor to deal with the matter.
Thank you. Permission, Chair. I think in properly discussing this issue, we would need to reflect on just a few provisions in the Principal Act, the current Act as it stands. It was made available to the members of the committee, so please just allow me in the discussion just very briefly to refer to some of the provisions in there. And maybe allow me, Chair, right at the outset to refer to a very simple example of what can possibly be regarded as, we've been speaking about P2P, so-called person-to-person betting. Even to my mind initially, I was kind of uncertain as to what is the exact nature of person-to-person betting, and pardon me, a very simplistic example. Two persons would, for instance, approach a betting exchange. The one person would bet 100 rand against the other person that Kaizer Chiefs would win the match that they would be playing with Orlando Pirates. So the betting exchange does no more but to facilitate the bet. Literally between two individuals, between two persons. That's where the expression person to person is coming from. Needless to say that the betting exchange in that little process would charge a fee or a commission for accepting and facilitating the bet between the two persons. Pardon me, Chair, you know our approach, and I hope and trust that it's invariably so, to be open and frank with the committee when it comes to discussing these matters. If we reflect on the testimony that was given during the public hearings by Betfair, being a betting exchange and situated in the UK, we will recall that really the essence of their criticism was, and we need to reflect here on the bill, that they would like the committee to, on page 3 of the bill, page 3 of the bill, it's just below the middle of page 3, it is a small Roman I in brackets, and the amendment relates to the definition of what is an interactive provider, which is the definition that we find in the Principal Act as it stands. And what they, in essence, are asking is that portion in that definition of interactive provider that is underlined, that it should be deleted, that it should be omitted from this bill. Because this was their contention, that based on the wording that is underlined here, that would exclude Betfair from having activities in respect of person-to-person betting. That is indeed so, Chair. Let it be frank, that was the intention of the policy decision that was taken by the DTI subsequent to the consultations, that by inserting this portion in their definition, that person-to-person betting would then be excluded from the ambit of the Principal Act, in that it would not qualify as an interactive gambling activity.
say, now, this is where you please need to pardon the reference to the principal act. I will be as brief as possible when it comes to that, but in order for the committee to take a proper decision, we would need to reflect on these provisions. In the principal act, there is a definition of interactive game. I won't read the whole definition, but it starts with, it means a gambling game played and then the rest. So we can clearly see that there is a direct link between the definition of interactive game and the definition of a gambling game. The definition of a gambling game is on the same page, it's just above the definition of interactive game, and it says a gambling game means any activity described as such in Section 5. Then we go to Section 5, and I won't read it here, save for this portion. So if we read the whole of Section 5 in the Principal Act, then we can see what is the essence. Thank you.
The Batman is looking for 10 or something.
Thank you, Chair. And if we can maybe only refer to subsection 2 of section 5, which is on page 20 of the Act, of the Principal Act. It says that despite subsection 1, for all purposes of this Act, none of the following activities is a gambling game. And then it says, a bet or wager in terms of subsection 4.1. Now if we read subsection 4.1, we will see even that the wording of that section is very similar to this exclusion that we're having in the bill in the definition of interactive provider. So yes, Chair, policy intention on the part of the DTI to exclude the person-to-person gambling from the ambit of the Principal Act. Chair, subsequent to the public hearings, we, and in view of the fact that the issue was so pertinently raised, we had no option but to go about and to reflect properly on the provisions that I've just referred to. And this is the contention that we need to make to the committee. This is our honest opinion as far as that is concerned. That even if the committee would agree to an amendment that would omit this underlying portion from the bill, then in any event, based on that despite provision in the Principal Act, person-to-person betting would not be allowed in terms of the Principal Act because it is excluded there. So the essence is this, that we would then, at a later stage when we meet again, we would propose an amendment to the committee resulting in the omission of the underlying portion and then conveying with that to the committee our opinion that we should not be misguided in this process, that we should not create the wrong impression that even if we do omit this portion, person-to-person betting in our view would not fall within the ambit of the Principal Act and would therefore not be an interactive gambling activity. If I can leave it there for the time being, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. The last issue, which in our view is going to result in changes to certain provisions of the bill, is on page 11. And is the fourth row, the comment column says other technical issues. Chair, we received a lot of technical comments from the Western Cape and the other provinces. and we are considering those proposed amendments, and we will be effecting certain changes. But Chair, there are other issues which we believe should really not go into the main legislation, and these are issues such as prescribed fees and the like, which we believe are better placed in regulations than in the Principal Act. I'll request my colleagues if there are any other issues that they think we should highlight at this stage. Otherwise, the rest of the other issues will really not result in changes in terms of the bill that is before the committee. But if there are any issues that they want to highlight or propose that they do so now. Chair, looks like there are no further comments. Those are the proposals that we want to put before the committee chair. And, thank you.
Just a quickie. The question of foreign institutions operating in South Africa, remember I raised the question of local presence. Can you answer that one?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, that issue is covered. Just trying to look for the relevant. I'm told it's on page 7. Yes, it says on the comment column, onshore requirements to ensure monitoring and inspection of service providers for FICA purposes. So what we are proposing is that foreign-based service providers should actually have a presence in South Africa. In other words, their equipment, their servers, as well as records of transactions should actually be in South Africa, so that if there is a need really to do any inspection, we should be able to do that. So there is a requirement for a local presence by foreign-based companies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Lavaskarni?
Yes, thank you, Chair.
I am concerned that the bill doesn't adequately, as you say, provision is made for these people, records and so forth in South Africa. I'm still concerned whether the bill makes it, despite all objections, casinos are a fact of life and we have to now accept them. So be it. I'm also aware that obviously if you visit these places, there's a lot being put into it in terms of infrastructure, employment, and so forth. That we don't seem to, to keep your records here, it could be a... I'm very concerned about a small type of operation. The internet nowadays, you get everything on a little stick the size of your finger. That we're providing a facility, which so be it, is that the requirements of substantial on-site investment in the country, in terms of building infrastructure and so forth, are not adequately addressed. I suppose it's a case of what source for the goose, what source for the gander. That there should be the same type of input imposed on these internet companies in their establishment in South Africa that we already face with your land-based casinos.
The other thing is, and I must say it's a little bit of, you know, whether internet, there seems to be a recent report, you know, in the BBC of how the revenues of internet gambling worldwide have declined. Well, I don't think we should place a bill on whether it's profitable or not. It's not my business. If you want to put in internet facilities and you discover that nobody's playing it, that's your problem, not mine. But there do also seem to be considerations in a few other countries, France and Germany. Has that current research taken place to address these concerns? I'm sorry, I was slightly delayed, Mr. Chair. I gather that the advertising matter for stringencies has been addressed. And it's, as I said, it's a case of, you know, this process started a long time ago, over 2.5 years ago. And, well, since the initial, legislation was. And my question is, when was the last research done? You know, as I said, because the internet industry changes so rapidly, you know, we could have been all good faith, and I accept everything, the difficulties that the department faces in putting something like this together. You know, it's a very complex situation, and a lot of work has gone into it, and a lot of good faith. But, you know, if one prepared something maybe a year ago, you know, what has come on the table, particularly with the rapid internet, I'm using this broadly, I'm not an expert on this subject, takes place with regard to these matters. So it's not quite a case that there might be a drop in gambling, I've said that's neither here nor there, but the other concerns in recent reports. I'll leave it at there, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Labaskasmi. A rejoinder from the department comment.
Thank you, Chair. The first question around local investment. This issue belongs really in license condition, because when the National Gambling Board or the licensing authority issues a license, it is their prerogative to put certain conditions which they would want the service provider or the licensee to meet. So we think that this particular aspect will be dealt with in license conditions, and we have actually dealt with it to say that internet service providers should be treated just like any other service provider, like land-based casinos and the like, in terms of the conditions that are attached to their licenses. So I think that issue is adequately addressed. The issue around decline in internet gambling. Well, the reason really why we had to come up with this amendment bill is the fact that our research, our consultation pointed to more and more people participating in the activity. And if you look around, there's a lot of advertising going on, stimulating demand for this type of gambling. And therefore, we thought that it's something that's probably going to be with us into the future, and therefore we needed to regulate it and control it. If it so happens that the activity declines in the future, well, so be it. However, for now, we think that it's something that really needs to be controlled and regulated. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ravis.
Chair, my apologies. I had to go to my office. I was a wee bit late. Now, it seems to me that the department is in consultation with a number of the agencies and so forth. Is there any indication when this particular, when the consultations will be stopped and when this particular bill will be tabled before the committee? Would it be on Friday or not, Chair? I'd just like to know.
Thank you, Dr. Ravi.
say, needless to say, that we can't be presumptuous on our part. But we had the advantage of the public hearings. We were all there, sitting, listening to all the testimony. And we already started early yesterday morning with a process of drafting amendments that would be proposed to this committee. And depending on the further guidance that we would be getting from the committee today, we will immediately, subsequent to this committee, continue with that process, and we will, on our part, be in a position to, on Friday morning, to present a proposed set of amendments to the committee for consideration.
Chair, but with respect, Chair, we'd like to study it beforehand. This is very intricate and so forth, Chairman. If I can have, say, at least a weekend to study the amendments, with due respect, I know we have time, but many of these are far reaching. If we might have it 2 or 3 days beforehand, just to study it, Chair.
Good folks, we'll get the amendments hopefully on Friday, and then see how far we can go with them. And then if it's necessary for members to mull over them over the weekend, then at the earliest opportunity, we need to meet and finalize. Because ideally, we have in our program scheduled the 5th of September to finalize this particular amendment. Comrade Hassan.
Thank you. You forgive me because I was a bit late, as I had to attend to some people that way. The issue of the moral issue, I don't know whether it has been addressed adequately, and it was raised very passionately by stakeholders, and we, as we have said, we and are convinced it's not our policy to protect gambling, but our policy is to protect individuals. You know, it's part of what it contains in the preamble of the Act. You know, our policy is to protect our people from gambling. Now, it has been a call that there should be something added on to demonstrate that all of what is done through regulation is towards phasing out gambling. I don't know whether you have considered that.
Comrade Hassan, you correctly say that you had to leave the room, and then some of those provisions have been spoken to, so that they can comment further. But there is a tightening up where it speaks to the purpose of the amendment and also the discouraging of this person to person. They've spoken to the relevant legislation. If you want to add.
Just in fairness to Tati Khosmeni, Chair, what we would be proposing is actually to amend the long title of the bill. Now, the long title of the bill is, it's the wording of that long title that give you the ambit and the parameters and the essence of the bill. And it's our intention to propose to the committee that that long title actually be amended together with the section on the purpose of the Act to make it very clear that what we have in mind here is a curtailment rather than a promotion, to speak also specifically on money laundering and the socio-economic ills of gambling.
Thank you, good folks. Any further comments?
With the omission of, I don't know the proper word that you used, of the person to person betting, because this happens, you know, generally in our community. Will it be considered an illegal activity? The case that she springs against Bali tomorrow. Few people, because I was in when we were talking to that one, few people would be actually engaged in this others. So, since now it is not dealt with, we are still going into researching it and so on. Does it mean, would it be considered lawful or unlawful for those people conducting such activity?
See, if we refer to the principal act, we will see in the offences and penalties clauses that what the principal act says is that if any gambling activity is taking place beyond the parameters of the principal act, then you're committing a statutory offence and you're liable to be convicted and you're liable to a fine. So that is very clear. Engaging in any gambling activity not provided for in the principal act, you would be committing an offence. So, yes, if person-to-person betting would be taking place, it would be beyond the ambit of this act, and it would constitute an offence. Unfortunately, as we all know, that it's something, it does happen out there, but the best that the department can do is to try and curtail it, to try and limit and restrict those activities.
I wonder how can this be communicated to our people nationwide, because I think this particular one, the example that you made, Kaiser Chiefs and other, it's actually happening in a large scale in our communities, and they don't know that this is an offense, you know, with regard to the law. They don't know.
That's where the role of members of parliament and the constituency officers come into play. You have to empower people with the knowledge of the law. And I'd also like to end where you started. You spoke about morality, norms and standards of communities. That's also where the issue will come in. Earlier on, we also said that it's a reality that people are gambling. And you are alluding to the same thing. Kaiser Chiefs and Pirates are playing a match. And people are going to say, yes, my 10 rand. If my team wins, I take your 10 rand. But what we also need to be very clear is that there's no way that any statute or law is going to be able to police everything that people does. Once you pass such law, it means that in the effect, if it cannot be supported with a sanction, it will be honored by its ignoring that law, you see. So you also have to be realistic. It's a multiplicity of issues that will have to be used. Legally, where it's practical, morally, upbringing, all those norms and standards of communities. So all these have to converge in order to reach the best possible outcome for our country.
I'm not trying to argue with you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think there is a border. Some of these things are, you know, bordering on what communities could term gambling and not gambling. Generally, people do not see such activities as gambling, the betting to betting. Some of it, not all of it, but some of them, betting to betting. You know, even in our ancient society, you say if certain things happen, I'll give you I'll give you a castle, and those things have been happening. Now they see gambling when things like Madais came into play and other machines and so on. That's why I was raising this issue that people may not know that they are involved in gambling, yet we here consider such things as gambling. Now, when I was calling for the department, the department is more resourced than us with our constituencies. you know, they've got access to TV, televisions and other mechanisms to actually speak to this thing so that everyone in the country,
Comrade Sussman, like a good politician, you've spoken. But the fundamental issue is still the same. We have to use all the resources. Department, society, constituency officers, in order to reach that outcome. So that, as I said, the multiplicity of challenges and addressing the issue. So we agree with you in highlighting some of the aspects. Good folks, it seems that for now we have covered. Mr. Abuskasni, I'm in doubt. No, continue.
Yes.
I have indulged Mr. Hasmi.
Okay.
So I must indulge.
Thank you.
My members.
A little niggling in the back of my mind is, you see, we've made certain requests and it's been sort of in discussion, but the license will take care of this and the license will take care of that. But of course we don't know what the license is going to say, and I suppose we wonder, do we will we have any input into see what the license conditions are? Is there any guarantee that the license conditions for these operators will differ from land-based casino operators, add-ons, you know, often to get a casino license, I know the practice is, you know, you had to make sure you've got to do this, and this, and this, and this. So we're taking a lot of concerns to a certain extent, you know, in good faith on the basis of what is the licensing authority. Now, is there, please help me, is it clear in the Act that the license conditions for this gambling will be exactly the same as the license conditions for land bases? I said, good faith is fine. It's always great until something goes wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Labuskasni. On that niggling note, the niggle is out in the open. Any comment?
Thank you, Chair. I'll sort of request my colleagues here to come in here. One of the things that was raised, or concerns that was raised by provinces, is the fact that we had proposed to put conditions in regulations so that the minister should prescribe those conditions. And this is primarily supposed to be the function of licensing authorities. However, what we are proposing on page 11 of the document, the middle row, which tries to address the issue around the ministerial powers, we are proposing that the minister will prescribe minimum conditions, and therefore licensing authorities or the National Gambling Board will then have to deal with the rest of the other conditions that should be attached to a particular license. We don't think that this is something that should go into the primary legislation. It's something that you want to give the licensing authority as a tool. But I'll give my colleagues to add to that. Thank you.
Chair, this is also an issue that we would like to raise on Friday in any event, but in fairness to this point was also very strongly made, if my memory serves me well, by the Western Cape Gambling Board. And we would like to concede something as far as that is concerned. We will also have further discussions with the state of advisors tomorrow, but for the time being, I think we can safely say the following. If I may refer to the bill, page 10 of the bill, close to the bottom of page 10, it's just above line 50. There's a subsection 3. It says the minister may prescribe conditions to be attached. to a license. So it clearly gives the minister the power to attach conditions to the interactive gambling license that will be issued by the National Gambling Board. I won't refer to the bill, but we can take it for granted that there's another provision in the bill that says it is the power of the National Gambling Board to attach conditions to the license. Now, with all due respect, Chair, that is inconsistent, and we've already conceded to the fact that we need to redress that. We can't, or the committee or parliament, with respect, can't give the same power to two different functionaries, the one being the minister, the other being the National Gambling Board. So that calls for redress, and we will propose an amendment on that. But to answer Mr. Lobskarni's question, is, what we do then intend to do is clearly to allow for a ministerial power in respective conditions to be attached to licenses, without giving the minister the power to attach the conditions him or herself. So the notion that we've been thinking of is the following: to give the minister the power to set criteria or a broad framework within which the National Gambling Board would then have to set or attach the conditions to the license. And we will also recall that there was a strong sentiment expressed by the committee during the previous debate that when it comes to ministerial powers, be they in regulations, be they somewhere else, there's a very strong feeling on the part of the committee that before they be published and before they be promulgated, that they should come here to this forum so that they can be properly considered by Parliament as well. So I think that has been the short answer to the question, and I hope it suffices, Mr. Lobskarni, that if we're then saying that whatever the minister may then be prescribing to the National Gambling Board when it comes to the attachment of conditions to a license would also be here for the purview and the screening of this forum and of Parliament.
I suppose what I'm looking for, and I need your guidance, is, you know, that something along the lines, you know, that any license, the conditions of any license granted to an interactive gambling operator will be substantially the same as for land-based. I mean, obviously you can't make, most probably, I would like it to be identical, but I mean, you know, there must be obviously room for maneuver. But I would really like to see in the conveyor of license, otherwise we run the risk of, you know, of you get different changes, different people, boards change, and we gradually move into sort of two sets of type of conditions. And that's all I'm trying to say, that if we have the act with sort of substantially the same conditions, if we can put it in appropriately, I think that will go a long way to looking at a fair approach, sort of what source for the goose and source for the gander. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Lobskarni, thank you very much. You adequately made the point earlier. You have just repeated it, but perhaps for effect. But I'm sure they heard you very clearly even in the first instance. Good folks, shall we leave it there until our next meeting on Friday? And then as members have expressed, as soon as you have the material ready with the latest changes, if we could possibly get it, if possible, before Friday, then it will also assist members to interact with the draft bills more timelessly and more in-depth, if they've added a day or so. So as soon as we have something ready, if possible, please circulate it so that we can look at it.
then it will make the process much faster and easier. Members and everyone else, it seems we have reached what we can do for the day. So there is a lunch. I won't say free lunch. It's not free lunch. You have worked for it. What time will it be served? After 12. You can ask them to bring it in now.
Could I have a 5-minute question? No, I need to say in the sense that you finished. I
would like to ask. DTR, you know, we've got, I'm getting bogged down by documents. You know, we had a 72-pager, 74-pager. Then we got this one again, 72-pager. And then we've got this one today. Where are we? What exactly does, you know, I'm trying to follow, and I'm getting a little confused. So just from, you know, from our point of view, is the first 74-pager out? Did this one we got yesterday or so replace the first one, or is it something, you know? And must this one be read with this one, or certain of these comments, it seems certain of these comments were based on previous inputs and are incorporated in the book. I just like a little guidance through the... Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. If I'm correct, I'll ask my colleague to also come in here. The first document is a summary of the comments that we received during the public comment period. It summarizes all the comments that we received. And the second document that was made available to the committee yesterday is a summary of the comments that were made during the parliamentary hearing and our response to those comments, as well as the recommendations on, in terms of how are we going to take those comments into account in terms of effective changes in the bill. I'm not sure if I explained that correctly.
Sorry, sir. I may come in. The reason why the documents are confusing as well is that the very same stakeholders who inputted into the first public comments are the very same stakeholders who came by the public hearing, and they raised more or less the same issues. There were no substantial differences.
15 seconds. Chair, if we may humbly ask for the purposes on Friday, what we strive to do in the document with the heading comments on gambling amendment bill that you made available yesterday and this morning, if it would be possible to focus on this document, because we've tried in here to isolate in general all the issues that were raised, and it would be the view that is adopted by the committee on this document that would inform our task when it comes to the drafting of amendments.
Thank you very much. So, good folks, meeting is adjourned for lunch.